Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and on this edition of Focus on Africa, Tanzania vows to continue with National Park Project after World Bank suspends funding.
The report by Auckland mentioned that almost 12 people disappeared and others were killed by rangers from the Ruaha National Park. And also they claimed that there is a multiple sexual assaults to women in some parts of Ruaha. But the government of Tanzania has even come and said that there is no violation of human rights and that is going to investigate and take a step.
How useful is cloud seeding and can it benefit Africa?
My professional view on this is that it's incredibly exciting science. You can demonstrate that it's possible to modify some clouds, but I don't think that the amount of water that you get out of the cloud is essentially cost effective.
And what's it like living with a disability in a South Sudanese refugee camp?
I'm person with visual impairment. The challenges in the camp, number one, is to do with white canes, and also information. It is very hard for someone with visual impairment to access information if are not provided or availed in Braille.
It's Thursday, April 25th. Tanzania has found itself caught up in another controversial tourism project marred by allegations of human rights abuses. The World Bank has announced that it is suspending funding to a project aimed at doubling the size of the Ruaha National Park in the south of the country after it was alerted of the allegations made by the US-based campaign group, the Auckland Institute. But the government hit back, saying that the allegations aren't true. The last couple of years have also seen conflict between the Tanzanian government and Maasai herders living in and around the Ngorongoro Conservation Area in the north. The Maasai activists claim they are being forcefully evicted from ancestral lands in favor of high-end tourism and hunting interests from the Middle East. The BBC's reporter in Dar es Salaam, Alfred Lastek, has been explaining all this to me. Alfred Lastek, welcome to the Focus on Africa podcast. It's great having you on the program once again. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, Richard. Everything is all well.
All right. So first, tell me about the project to expand the Ruaha National Park. What has the government been doing there with the World Bank's support?
First of all, to understand more this REGROW, which means resilient natural resource management for tourism and growth, is a project that seeks to improve the management of natural resources and tourism in some priority areas in the southern part of Tanzania. And the government has been working with the World Bank since 2017, implementing the project worth $150 million US dollars. Over the recent months, we had a report from a California-based institute claiming that there is a mass human rights violation in the area, and the World Bank decided to suspend the funds.
Alfred, let me just interject there because I want to understand something here. So the World Bank has suspended funding for this project because of the allegations of human rights abuse. So what exactly has been alleged? What sort of abuses are we talking about? Who are the victims here?
Specifically, they are claiming that there is a lot of killings and sexual assaults that have been facing people in communities that are living nearby the Ruaha National Park. The report by Auckland mentioned that almost 12 people disappeared and others were killed by rangers from the Ruaha National Park. And also they claimed that there is a multiple sexual assaults to women in some parts of Ruaha. But till today, we have not had any report specifically from the police force, maybe saying that there was something like a killing or something like a sexual assault that has been reported before the law enforcers in Tanzania. So, and the government of Tanzania has even come yesterday and said that there is no violation of human rights and that is going to investigate and try to see if these allegations are valid, and they will take a step, but also they will come forward and tell how the situation is. So far, the government of Tanzania says that they've already spent over $125 million USD, which is around 8% of the whole amount, and they feel that nothing will stop them from doing the project. And on top of that, the government has said that before these allegations, it had said that it has some plans to relocate some of these people living around Ruaha area especially near the national park, to a different area. Remember that this national park is also one of the national parks which has this great Ruah River, which is one of the longest rivers in Tanzania. And that river pours almost 25 to 30% of the water that is needed at the new Tanzania hydroelectric project, which is called Mwalimu Nyerere, which is expected to produce around 2,000 megawatts of electricity. And so this river, which passes across the national park, normally faces a lot of dry spells. For the last 2 years, I've been visiting there and doing stories on impacts of climate change. We'll find that river, which is very dry. And the basic thing that they are claiming as the national park, they say that human activities around east and west of the national park, the ones which are contributing to these challenges of dry spells, because there is a lot of irrigation activities that are going on, which are of more of commercial irrigation, which they are doing a lot of plantations. So what I think and what I've been hearing from the authorities is that they're trying to relocate people from that place to other places so that there is a lot of improvement in the tourism around the national park. And so on the process is when there is allegations that they are forcing people, there are abuses inside there, and a lot of many things.
Yeah, and the World Bank has suspended funding for this project. What happens next? So what's the fate of this project?
Oh, the World Bank, in its statement that we tried to contact yesterday, the World Bank said that they will continue to work with authorities and local communities to ensure all projects are there to improve the lives of Tanzanians. And they said that they are very concerned about the allegation of abuse and the injustice which is related to the program. And so they want the authorities to figure out, and the project will continue as everything is okay.
And this is not the only tourism project that has attracted some criticism in Tanzania and outside of Tanzania. Just remind us, what has been happening in the north of the country among the Maasai communities?
So for around 2 or 3 years, there have been ups and downs between the authorities also in Ngorongoro district, where we find Ngorongoro Conservation Area. And also we find Loliondo, which is the game reserve, on the same area as the same situation that is claimed to be in the southern of Tanzania. Activists have been claiming that there is a lot of violation of human rights. It is trying to push forcefully the Maasai community, which is a big community found around Ngorongoro, who have been living in the national park, the wild animals, and that is the ancestral land. And so the challenge has been the government trying to relocate them and trying to find the number of people living in that area go down. And so on the process, some of these Maasai, they have moved away to a certain coastal place called Andeni, and they have settled, but there are some who have resisted. And so there is a challenge that lots of rights defenders are still trying to push and see this Maasai community getting their rights and living where they were born. The same applies to Loliondo. It's claimed that, they are trying to move the communities around there just to pave way for hunting businesses. And so that brought some clashes last year, and some of these Maasai people were very injured. The policeman also lost his life on the process of the fights. We even got some of these people going for treatment in southern Kenya, Narok County. Still, there is a lot of contest between the government and these communities, and it has not been something that has settled since it started.
All right, Alfred Lastek, thank you so much for giving us a perspective about this developing story. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Richard.
When heavy rainfall flooded parts of Dubai recently, turning streets into rivers and causing major disruption at the world's second busiest airport, it sparked speculation that maybe cloud seeding was responsible. Dubai, which is situated on the coast of the United Arab Emirates, is usually very dry, and in recent years, it has experimented with cloud seeding technology to help address water shortages. The technique has been around for decades and has been tried in a few African countries. So what's cloud seeding and how effective is it? To help answer these questions, I called up Professor Richard Washington, who is a climate scientist based at the University of Oxford in the UK. He was involved in early cloud seeding experiments back in the 1990s. A few years ago, he was actually on a jet carrying out cloud seeding over the South Africa-Mozambique border. So I began by asking him, what was that experience like?
As a young scientist, those kind of opportunities don't come better. You know, it's a chance to slip into a Learjet, find an active thunderstorm and go and fly right through it a few times. Most civil aviation aircraft have to stay several miles clear of thunderstorms. And here we were finding a really active one and going into it. So it was a brilliant experience. As a climate scientist, you spend a lot of time looking at bits and bytes on a computer and seldom getting that close to the real action. So it's something that I'll never forget.
What type of aircraft is that? What does it really look like on the inside?
It's like a little executive jet, a Learjet, so probably 10 seats or so, pretty small, just a tube with very, very strong wings. I think a Learjet had its origins in military design, so it was a good choice of aircraft for that sort of enterprise because it could withstand a lot of stress. The updrafts and downdrafts inside the thunderstorms are pretty intense, so you need a strong aircraft to be able to deal with them.
Cloud seeding has been sort of like a buzzword lately, so what is it and how does that work?
The idea really is to try and improve the efficiency of rainfall from clouds. And if you think of what rain is, it's essentially what happens when droplets of water or hail in or snow inside cloud just becomes too heavy to be upheld by the drafts of air that are going upwards. And eventually it just falls out down to the ground. So the cloud seeding effort essentially is to intercept that process at just the right place, just the right moment, and to try and encourage the business of growing droplets of water or ice particles. And as you know, clouds are made up of lots and lots of little bits of water. In the kinds of clouds that don't produce a lot of rain, those bits of water are essentially too small to fall out as rain and too small to merge into larger droplets that might fall out as rain. So essentially, in a lot of clouds, those small bits don't grow. They either get evaporated in a few minutes' time in the life cycle of the cloud, or else they get pumped to the top of the atmosphere in thunderstorm clouds when, you know, those big anvils that you see made of ice. So seeding essentially tries to interrupt that process by encouraging the growth of particles and placing those particles in just the right part of the storm.
And how does that trigger an increase in the amount of rainfall?
Broadly speaking, there's two kinds of clouds that you're looking at, or two kinds of cloud seeding. There's static seeding and dynamic seeding. So in the case of static seeding, you're looking at interrupting processes at mid-altitude, so quite high up in the storm. And there, the cloud will be made of very cold water, actually below freezing point, called supercooled water. And if you introduce ice into that supercooled water, the ice begins to grow at the expense of water droplets, and that promotes a larger particle more quickly. So that's the static seeding approach. And then dynamic seeding applies to warmer clouds, where you encourage the condensation of water vapor, so that's water as gas, into droplets, which you hope then will fall out as rain. And typically how this is done is by injecting some particles, silver iodide, for instance, or dry ice, either by aircraft, which is very expensive, sometimes by drones, and that's a space that's expanding at the moment, or by flares. And the flares can be shot from the ground or else attached to the back of the aircraft wing.
So would I be right to say that it's basically artificial rain that's being produced in this case?
Yes, you can't make it a cloud that isn't there, but you can, and it's been shown to be the case, improve the amount of water that falls out, or increase the amount of water that falls out of the cloud.
In terms of effectiveness, is there any evidence to suggest that it is?
You have to do what's called a randomized seeding experiment. So if you and I were to go and fly that Learjet and put it inside a cloud and seed that cloud, The problem is that you can't compare what that cloud might have done if we weren't there with what it goes on to do once we've seeded it, because it's only one cloud and it's had its lifetime interrupted. So what you have to do is build a database of an experiment where you've altered the cloud in some way, or at least attempted to alter the cloud in some way, and a control database where you've measured the cloud but not altered it. So that's essentially the basis of randomized seeding. But that's very expensive because it means that about 50% of the missions that you fly have to have the no seeding criteria, which is only revealed essentially once you're in flight. So there's no bias to them. So a lot of these seeding experiments have to run for several years before they can plausibly be tested. The reality is that there's a lot of projects that don't do this randomized seeding. They just essentially fly around and try and alter the clouds, making claims that they sometimes have, but without the statistics to back it up.
And has this been tried anywhere in Africa? Because I remember in the earlier part of the conversation, you talked about your own personal experience in South Africa.
In South Africa, there were projects that ran for many years in Nelspruit, now Mbombela, and also in the Orange Free State in Bethlehem. One was trying to modify large clouds, and the Bethlehem project was trying to modify the smaller, warmer clouds. But I've read recently also that there's attempts to do cloud seeding in Zimbabwe, Ethiopia, and Niger. I think there was an article just a couple of weeks ago in the Herald in Zimbabwe where the Ministry of Environment, Climate, and Wildlife Permanent Secretary, Professor Matonde, was speaking about efforts to use a plane to cover all the provinces in Zimbabwe to do seeding efforts because of the ongoing droughts in that part of Southern Africa at the moment.
You've just talked about Zimbabwe and Zambia, and much of Southern Africa really is currently battling a severe drought. And so we've had a couple of countries, you know, declaring it a national disaster and emergency. Do you think this would really be beneficial for Africa and especially for countries when, you know, they're battling these extreme weather conditions?
My professional view on this is that it's incredibly exciting science. You can demonstrate that it's possible to modify some clouds, but I don't think that the amount of water that you get out of the cloud is essentially cost effective. You have to fly a lot, and it takes a long time to be able to prove what you've done anyway. So I don't think it's a good use of resource. You can learn through the projects quite a lot about how the thunderstorms work, and that can have a feedback on forecasting. But essentially, liter for liter, there are better ways of using your money in my eyes.
I'm curious to ask, so how much cloud would you need, you know, to make a seeding effective?
You probably need to fly hundreds of clouds and to seed them regularly over very large regions to have any effect at all. The science has been going on for decades, and I think if it had been properly demonstrated that you could essentially squeeze water out of the atmosphere this way, it would be much more widespread than it is.
You know, Dubai has really been the point of focus because of the recent flooding there. And Dubai has been hosting, you know, this seeding mission since the early 1990s. Would there have been a relation between the extreme rainfall with cloud seeding in Dubai? I know there's been really a lot of speculation about that.
I'm absolutely convinced there's no relationship at all. That storm was forecast well in advance, so several days prior to the storm itself. And the conditions across that region were so conducive to rain. I mean, the storm looked bigger than France, so it's just implausible that cloud seeding efforts could ever have produced something like that.
What would be the downside of, you know, cloud seeding? Are there like any environmental or health implications?
Generally, it's safe. I think the downside really is just it's an incredibly expensive thing to do for very little demonstrable gain.
I'm currently in Nairobi, where much of the city is currently submerged because of, you know, extreme rainfall. I don't think we have received this amount of rainfall in so many years. And just across in other parts of the continent, we're seeing countries now declaring a national disaster and emergency because of drought there. How would you explain this phenomena that we're currently experiencing?
Typically, the El Nino phenomenon produces dry conditions over southern Africa, so South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, Zambia, and that's what we see in play at the moment. But it produces wetter conditions over East Africa, so Tanzania, Uganda, Kenya. Normally, the signal isn't very strong for the long rain, so March, April, May, and we're in the middle of those at the moment. But it's likely that what we're seeing in the production of rainfall is bound up with adjustments to where the thunderstorms happen in response to El Nino itself.
Thank you very much, Richard Washington, for speaking to us on Focus on Africa podcast.
Thank you, Richard.
Professor Richard Washington, a climate scientist based at the University of Oxford. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. I'm Richard Kagoi. It's been more than a year since war broke out in Sudan, and the fighting shows no signs of abating. It is estimated that 8 million people have been internally displaced, with millions fleeing the country. 600,000 of those have reached neighboring South Sudan, and amongst them are an often hidden minority, disabled people. An estimated 1 in 6 refugees in South Sudan has a disability, and they often face unique challenges that their non-disabled compatriots don't face. Can you imagine fleeing a war zone whilst blind, or negotiating packed trucks whilst in a wheelchair? Once those disabled refugees have made their perilous journey to South Sudan's capital, Juba, they might meet Abilo Theophilus, who has made it his mission to make refugee camps more inclusive for those with a disability. Abilo, himself partially sighted, works in one of the capital's most populated refugee camps. He's an advocate for disability rights. But first, let's hear from 41-year-old Hamer al-Imam Muhammad al-Bashir, who fled the war in Sudan and is now in Juba. He told me what it was like fleeing the war as a person with disability and eventually becoming a refugee. Hamir's story was read by one of my colleagues here at the BBC.
My journey has been difficult and dangerous. I have a wife and children in Egypt. They left when the war started, but I stayed behind to manage our computer and electronics maintenance workshop. I stayed to protect our assets, but everything is gone now. The armies took everything, including our money, leaving us with nothing. They fired at me and told me to leave. It is really sad. Now I am in Juba, staying at a facility for disabled people. The journey from Sudan to South Sudan was tough and dangerous. I haven't eaten for days. The war has destroyed the country. Many people have died or become disabled. I have a son and a daughter, and I miss them so much. I cannot call them because I don't work and cannot afford airtime. My dream is to go back home with my family one day and reunite with them.
Now to Abilo Theophilus and Sophia Mohammed, Country Director at Light for the World. Yeah, let me start off with you, Sophia. You know, what are some of the stories you hear from disabled refugees who have been making the journey from Sudan to South Sudan? What are some of the unique challenges that they do face?
People with disabilities, the main challenge is accessibility. When you see the people, over 500,000 refugees or returnees from Khartoum, the number of people with disabilities is very less, because that means they don't reach to the safe space because of lack of transportation. So accessibility is the main issue when it comes to persons with disabilities. And also attitude. Attitude is also one of the barriers when it comes to people with disabilities. In most cases, they are left behind. I have been interacting with returnees from Khartoum, and I realized that many people with disabilities are left behind because people had to save their own lives, so they had to leave others behind. So
this must be very challenging, and I can imagine what it's like for them, having made, you know, what's a very difficult journey, especially when they're crossing the border. Abilo, when they arrive at the camp, what are some of the difficulties that they face?
One of them is basic necessity like water. Even the one they're having is not even safe. Life indeed is so difficult in the camp. And most of people of Spain live in camp for so many years. You will find that the informations are not available for people who are blind, white canes, and also wheelchair for people with physical, those who are using wheelchair.
Right. Just looking at the statistics and specifically in the camp. So we're looking at one in six of those in the camp have a disability. Why are the rates so high?
The rate is high because, for example, when they come all the way from Khartoum to South Sudan, there might be an injury on the way. And that can also be one of the causes. And from our experience, we found out that there are also people with disabilities injured. Some of them even came with a bullet in one of their limbs. So, of course, in such a situation, accidents can also cause disability. That's why the number is high when it comes to persons with disabilities.
Mm-hmm. And Abilo, because you have people with disability in the camp, there's so many challenges that we've pointed out, especially when they travel and when they arrive at the camp. So what is being done to help them, you know, just to cope in the camp?
I think, first of all, we are starting by assessing their needs. And of course, their needs depend according to the types of the impairments. After that, we'll give them training. For those who need white cane, we'll provide white cane. And also for those who need wheelchair, we provide. And also we look at the structure which are already built. If needs any modification, we'll modify so that it can be used by all persons with disability. And also we are giving training to the community leaders on disability awareness. And also to the parents of children with disability on how they can be able to handle people with disability and how they can be able to use an appropriate and positive terminology for them. So they will not use their impairment, but they can use their given name first.
Sophia, as they're being assisted on how to cope, so then how do they access, say, food, water, basic necessities, you know, such as toilets. How do you help?
Okay, the first intervention that we do as Light for the World is to train mainstream organizations or humanitarian actors. We have to make sure that their programs are inclusive of persons with disabilities. As a disability-focused organization, we might not reach all, but through these humanitarian agencies, we try to advocate for the rights of refugees with or returnees with disabilities. So that's our first intervention. And then the second intervention is also to work with the camp managers, the community leaders, because some disabilities are not visible, especially children with disabilities are not identified easily. So by empowering camp management so that children with disabilities also will come out and access the necessary services. We also do pilot projects to make sure that organizations will adapt those pilot initiatives, like modifying a pit latrine, which is in the camp, to make sure that it's accessible for people with disabilities, and also work with young people without disabilities as a support group. The young people without disabilities normally support those with disabilities, especially during food distribution. They support people with disabilities to access food and non-food items easily.
Right. And I just want to hear from you, Adilo. You are visually impaired. What's it like living in South Sudan? What are some of the challenges you face on a day-to-day?
Yes, because I'm a person with visual impairment. The challenges persons with visual impairment face in the camp, number one, is to do with white canes, lack of white canes is not there. And also information, it is very hard for someone with visual impairment to access information if are not provided or availed in Braille. So these are the challenges.
I can imagine, despite the challenges that you face personally, you work with a lot of people who have been through so much, you know, difficulty, people who are fleeing conflict and they are severely, you know, traumatized. How do you help them, you know, cope or deal with the mental health impact of war?
I think what we used to do to returnees who are with disability, we do give them psychosocial support and counseling after we counsel them, and then we give them psychosocial support. We will encourage them, we'll advise them so that they will not be stressed or traumatized a lot, or they will not be having a lot of problems in their mind because of the war or because of the impairment or the challenge that they might have been going through. So we will counsel them and give them some sort of advices. And then I will give myself as a role model or an example for them. Now I'm a visually impaired, but I can be able now to come up with a life with the rest of my colleagues who don't have disability. So for you, since you have fled the conflict and you are here, slow by slow, tomorrow you will be okay. So don't think of what has happened, but you need to encourage yourself.
All right, a huge challenge there, but we have to leave it there for now. So thank you so much, Sophia and Abido, for speaking to us here on Focus on Africa. That's it for this edition of Focus on Africa. It was produced by Rob Wilson, Patricia Whiteon, and Bella Hassan in London. Paul Bachbinga was in charge of this production, and Danny Cox was our technical producer. Andrew Lombard and Alice Modengi are the editors. I'm Richard Kagoye. Let's talk again next time.